Mohammed bin Salman. As we've reported, the CIA has determined that Mohammed bin Salman ordered the killing of a journalist, Jamal Khashoggi, but the president still doesn't endorse that. Let's listen.
I hate the crime. I hate what's done. I hate the cover-up. And I will tell you this, the Crown Prince hates it more than I do, and they have vehemently denied it. The CIA points it both ways.
Again, NPR has been told the CIA doesn't point it both ways. But that part about the Crown Prince regretting this, hating this more than he does, what's he saying there?
You know, President Trump has been very transactional in his approach to this. And more than anything, he seems to be looking for an out because he wants to continue to have strong relations with Saudi Arabia, even as members of Congress are pushing back firmly, saying that the U.S. needs to respond.
Okay, Tamara, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
That's NPR's Tamara Keith.
Democrats may end up flipping 40 House seats this year. Many of that party's wins in the midterms were in the suburbs. Districts around Chicago, Los Angeles, Houston, and Oklahoma City all went blue. So how's that going to translate in the future? NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben traveled to Atlanta to try to find out.
I'm in all the groups, though.
A lot of us are in
multiple
all
groups.
Rebecca Sandberg and Jane Russell are politically active, maybe hyperactive. Sandberg counts at least five local political groups that she's involved in. But this fall, at a bar in Roswell, Georgia, she and some parents from her kids' school decided to do even more.
We had been meeting here on Sundays sometimes for Bloody Marys because, by the way, they have great Bloody Marys here. And we decided one Sunday to add postcards to that. So we wrote postcards for a lot of local candidates that were running.
Activists like Sandberg helped propel Democrat Lucy McBath to a win in Georgia's 6th congressional district this year. That's a big victory for Democrats in a seat that, as recently as 2016, elected a Republican by 23 points.
The fact that we turned it in 2 years is pretty amazing.
Democrats like Sandberg already have a new question. Can their party keep all of these suburban seats at just one? David Wasserman is a political analyst at the Cook Political Report.
Those are going to be the first districts that Republicans pursue in their bid to win the majority.
That said, a few factors could work in Democrats' favor. Demographics is a big one.
Those districts could be much better for Democrats 2 years from now than they are today because the old Republican base in those districts is, for lack of a better term, dying out.
Georgia 6, for example, is rapidly becoming more diverse. And for McBath, who is herself African-American, one big focus was energizing non-white voters. Alabama Democratic Representative Terry Sewell campaigned for her.
I think that Lucy was really effective in engaging communities that had not been engaged before. Women voters as well as minority voters. She really concentrated on that, and that really made a difference.
Race is just one demographic challenge Republicans face. For years, Democrats have also steadily been doing better with college-educated voters who are concentrated in many suburbs. There's something else that's harder to measure. Democrats here talk about how they hid their beliefs before 2016. Now they've banded together. Jen Cox is founder of the local women's activist group, Pave It Blue.
A lot of people didn't have it on their radar that they could be this involved in the process, and now there's no turning back from that. They've switched out their social life for their activist life.
But hold on. Until recently, Republicans routinely won this seat by huge margins. They also eked out a special election win in 2017. In short, this year's midterms don't mean Democrats will have an easy path in Georgia 6 or in other suburbs. Jesse Hunt, spokesman for the National Republican Congressional Committee, says he's bullish on the GOP's future here. But he acknowledges they have work to do on how to appeal to more suburban voters.
Those are the conversations that we're going to have among party leaders, grassroots activists, over the next couple months as we, begin to mount our comeback.
Local Republicans have some prescriptions. Jason Shepard is chair of the Cobb County Republican Party.
We heard very little of how great the economy is. We heard very little about how the tax cuts are working. We misplaced those pocketbook issues that really are what voters in the suburbs and more urban areas care about most.
That message was lost, he said, when President Trump so heavily emphasized immigration. In this part of the state, more Republicans chose Marco Rubio than Donald Trump in the 2016 primary. Michael Williams, head of the Cobb County Young Republicans, says it's important to confront that moving forward.
If we're not dealing with Donald Trump Republicans here, then we need to be able to articulate where we are also not Donald Trump Republicans. Where do we part with the president and where do we stand with him?
For all the strategizing people like Williams do on the local level, national trends can dominate. For example, in a midterm year like 2018, the president's party tends to fare poorly.
We can knock our knuckles raw on doors. We can be making thousands and thousands of phone calls. And then stuff that happens in D.C. at the national level filters down and affects what happens around here. And there's nothing we can really do about it. So 2020 is going to be a whole different ballgame.
And whether or not President Trump says he was on the ballot this year, he will be next time. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
As he tries to transform the economy of France, President Emmanuel Macron has faced off and won against organized unions. But now he faces a problem from a leaderless grassroots protest movement, which threatens to derail his plans. It is called the Yellow Vest Protest Movement, and it began last week in response to the government's plans to raise gas prices. Here's NPR's Eleanor Beardsley.
An irritated driver gets out of his car and demands that the yellow-vested protesters let him through. Scenes like this have been playing out all week at toll roads and intersections across France. The protesters are known as gilets jaunes, or yellow vests, because they wear the fluorescent vest every French motorist must keep in his car.
It's a spontaneous movement that was considered with disdain by the government. It was nothing at the beginning.
That's Christian Macarion with news magazine L'Express. He says the movement has now swelled out of control and nobody knows how far it will go. Among its ranks are retirees and the unemployed, farmers, housewives, and people who have never protested before. One newspaper called it the revenge of the diesel class. What unites them is the economic pinch and anger at a president who seems far removed from their daily hardships. At more than $6 a gallon, the French already pay some of the highest prices for gasoline. 60% of the pump price is taxes, and now the government wants to raise them to finance the country's transition to a green economy. Marc Le Fur, a congressman from Brittany, says that's a nebulous concept for most people.
It's unbearable. I am a rural congressman, and my people work far from their homes. They are blue-collar workers with shift work and low salaries, and there is no public transportation. A year ago, the president encouraged people to take jobs far from home, and now he's making it too costly to do so.
Despite annoyances, injuries, and even two accidental deaths caused by the protests, a poll out this morning shows 77% of the French support the Yellow Jackets. After refusing to budge, last night Macron said his government would announce some concessions next Tuesday. Meanwhile, some 30,000 yellow vest protesters are expected to descend on Paris tomorrow and have threatened to bring the French capital to a standstill. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
Hey, thanks for listening to your public radio station, which brings you Morning Edition. You can get the latest news this afternoon on All Things Considered. And follow us anytime on social media. You can find all your Morning Edition hosts on Twitter if you'd like. I'm NPR Inskeep. There's NPR Green. That's David Green. Rachel Martin is Rachel NPR. And Noel King is Noel King. This is NPR News.
Good morning. 8:19 now, and you're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining me today. I'm Melissa Ingalls. Coming up in 15 minutes, after years of price hikes, the cost of the average Affordable Care Act policy is dropping across the country. Competition among insurers has increased as the political uncertainty starts to settle down. More on that coming up.
Every news day starts with questions. We want to know what's happening, who's making it happen, and what it means for the state of Wisconsin and its people. What you hear on All Things Considered is what we found, what we learned, and what we can share with our neighbors and the people in our community.
Learn something new on All Things Considered with Brady Carlson every weekday from 4 until 6:30 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from The Century House, featuring Herman Miller furniture and stressless Norwegian recliners on University Avenue in Madison. The Century House, furnishing homes and offices since 1948. CenturyHouseInc.com.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a one-stop shop for the holidays. Eat at Jack's Cafe and then peruse their collection of holiday decor. Unique gifts for everyone on your list and have them gift-wrapped for free. 2401 60th Street, Kenosha.
And WPR weather for today, a mix of sun and clouds, breezy with some scattered rain showers in the afternoon and evening, highs in the mid-40s. Mostly cloudy on Saturday, a chance of rain and snow showers, especially in the northern part of the state. Highs in the low to mid-40s. Sunday, partly sunny and windy in the north, rain and snow in the south, and there might be several inches of snow by the end of the day Sunday. Highs from the mid-30s to the mid-40s.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Hanes, donating 225,000 pairs of socks to homeless shelters and more than 2.5 million pairs since 2009. Information on how to help the homeless is at hanes.com/sockdrive. From Ancestry, supporting the Great Thanksgiving Listen and StoryCorps' mission to encourage people to explore, share, and preserve their family stories together this holiday season. Learn more at ancestry.com/NPR. And from Trader Joe's, with new seasonally available products and new always available episodes of the podcast series Inside Trader Joe's at Apple Podcasts or where podcasts are found. More at TraderJoe's.com.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. It's the day after Thanksgiving, which means that shoppers are already lining up outside stores across the country for Black Friday sales. As a matter of fact, some people have been waiting for stores to open since Tuesday evening.
But if waiting in line's not your thing, you have some alternatives. You can shop online, of course.
Or you can hire a company like Washington, D.C.'s Skip the Line to pay someone to hold your spot in line. There are similar companies in New York and Nebraska.
So here's a question. Does this bug the actual shoppers standing in line? Are they annoyed at these placeholders? Here's founder of Skip the Line, Jennifer Goff.
We always tell the people behind us, hey, you know, there's going to be some people joining us here.
Okay, so suppose you were to reach out to a service like this. How much will it cost?
The average price is about $30 an hour.
Hey, sometimes you got to spend money to save money.
But wait a minute. If you're going to, like, stand in line from Tuesday to Friday at $30 an hour, that better be some amazing deal.
In India, prostitution is illegal, but the government there routinely overlooks the brothels that operate openly and the millions employed by the industry. Many women are born into the sex trade or trafficked at a young age. It's rare that any of them get out. One woman, though, has devoted much of her life to helping the children of sex workers break that cycle. NPR's Windsor Johnston traveled to Calcutta to meet her.
At the entrance of Sonaghachi, India's largest red light district, three prostitutes wearing bright yellow and red saris stand in a huddle at the corner. Their pimps, or babus, are close by watching. Multi-story brothels line the narrow alleys. Inside, young women walk around in towels, while others sit cross-legged on dingy mattresses. The stench of raw sewage and traces of bleach seeps through the rooms. This is where Rashida Bibi works. She was trafficked from Bangladesh at the age of 16 with the promise of a well-paying job, a nanny.
But after giving me shelter for a few days, a woman told me, I cannot keep you anymore, and you have to start working as a prostitute. I was very young and didn't know what to do. So the older women dressed me up and took me to the main street and negotiated money with the clients.
That was almost 30 years ago, she thinks. Bibi guesses she's 45, but she isn't sure. She can't read or write, and for her, there will be no way out of this life. But for her children, perhaps.
One, two, three, start!
Bibi's 15-year-old daughter is enrolled in a program called New Light, which cares for and educates the children of sex workers in the red light district of Kaligat. Each night, the kids sing the Indian National Anthem before getting to work on their evening lessons. New Light's founder, Ermi Basu, arrived here nearly 20 years ago as a sociologist.
I walked in through this narrow lane with rooms on both sides, rooms measuring more or less 5 feet by 7 feet. It was dark, miserable, forgotten space. Sometimes I saw an older woman holding onto a baby, sitting right outside the doorway where a mother was entertaining her client inside.
The experience changed her life.
I felt, how can I go back from here and not do anything?
Basu grew up in Calcutta in a middle-class family of social activists. After deciding she wanted to help, residents of Kaligat gave her a small room on the first floor of a two-story building to set up a nighttime drop-off shelter for kids. Today, it's grown into a place where children can get help with homework, some basic health care, clothing, and food. Mostly, it's a safe place to sleep when their mothers are working. Basu encourages the children to imagine a different future.
Your life, your experience can make change in other lives. That is our purpose, to be on this planet.
Tonight, Basu is talking to a group of young women who are sitting in a circle at New Light's Home for Girls.
Our purpose is just not to eat, not to sleep, you know, not to laugh, and okay, sometimes happy, sometimes sad, and then to get married, have children, and die. No, no. Our lives are meant to change the world around us, beginning with ourselves.
One of them is 15-year-old Shabani Singh. She was 6 when her mom died of AIDS-related tuberculosis. She says Basu stepped in to fill the void.
She's a role model, our inspiration, a great pillar for us, standing in front of us, guiding us, seeing us.
Now, Shabani's studying fashion design. She'd like to eventually open up her own shop, making clothes and accessories.
All kinds of, like, Indian style, Western styles, many kind of gowns and saris, and also make earrings with jewelry.
New Light Now also has a home for boys. Tonight, teenagers play traditional Indian tunes on tabla drums. 19-year-old Rakesh Singh has lived here for 3 years and dreams of opening his own restaurant one day.
Very much I like that Chinese food. Chinese, Spanish, Mexican. Sometimes I cook over here that chili chicken.
Basu says more than 600 children have passed through New Light in its 18 years. They've gone on to jobs in restaurants, hotels, gas stations. Some have gone to college and now teach at New Light. Not one is a sex worker, says Basu. But keeping the program running has been an ongoing challenge. New Light operates solely on private donations, and Basu sometimes worries about having enough money to pay her staff. But she says her biggest concern is keeping New Light a safe place for the kids.
I can probably imagine or plan where we would like to be, but there is no guarantee that we would get there. Because anything can happen at any moment. There can be a riot, some pimps can come and tear our place down, there can be a fire, I could be shot or killed or knifed, whatever.
Dusk settles over New Light as students sit in meditation before the start of the evening class. The demand is constant. Basu says every time one graduates, another child shows up. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Calcutta.
This is NPR News.
One of the hottest trends in education is personalized learning.
It moves you out of your comfort zone, but then it extends your comfort zone once you get used to it.
The idea is that each student learns at their own pace.
You get to make choices instead of the teacher choosing what we get to do.
So how do teachers feel about that? That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 here on Wisconsin Public Radio with your host, Brady Carlson.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
It's 8:29 now, morning edition on WPR. We'll have the latest news for you in just a moment. And in about 15 minutes, it's Wisconsin Life with a look at a Native American food tradition. WPR's Daniel Kading gets a lesson on how to make fry bread coming up.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Analysts say this should be a strong Black Friday for retailers across the U.S. with unemployment low and consumer confidence high. Holiday shoppers are crowding stores and looking for big discounts online. Kimberly Palmer is a personal finance expert with the website NerdWallet. She cautions sometimes those deals on big ticket items really are too good to be true.
In a lot of cases, the retailer is offering that low price because they're offering a stripped down version of the television that you might expect to be getting.
ShopperTrack expects holiday shoppers in the U.S. to spend $23 billion before the end of the day. Authorities in Alabama say a fight between two people at a mall in suburban Birmingham ended with gunfire. Two people were wounded last night at the River Chase Galleria in Hoover. An 18-year-old suspect was later shot and killed by police. Greg Rector is with the Hoover Police Department. He says some officers were at the mall at the time of the shooting because of the holiday shopping.
This is a big shopping day for us, as it is for people all over the country. Numerous Hoover police officers were already on the scene working various assignments inside the Galleria and outside.
The death toll is up to 84 in California's deadliest and most destructive wildfire on record. Authorities in Butte County say the remains of another person were discovered yesterday. The campfire is now 95% contained. This is NPR News.
This is news from Wisconsin Public Radio, 8:31 now. I'm Melissa Ingalls. The University of Wisconsin is working with a Green Bay nonprofit to put the Wisconsin back into the traditional Wisconsin fish fry. A UW Green Bay fish biologist is working with an urban farm to create a year-round source of yellow perch. Patty Murray reports.
What's a Friday without fish fry? Native yellow perch is hard to find due to invasive species and unpredictable weather. Much of the fish is imported from Canada. That's according to UWGB fish biologist Ken Webb. He's working with the nonprofit Farmery in downtown Green Bay. They're building tanks that look sort of like hot tubs to breed the fish. The Farmery will sell fingerlings to other fish farmers.
Then they can start to invest in their own hatchery. Or maybe somebody says, you know what? I've got a warehouse in downtown Kenosha, and I can turn that into my own indoor perch hatchery, and I can produce 5 million a year.
If the project is successful, Webb hopes the cost of a Friday night dinner may go down. Patty Murray, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Democratic Governor-elect Tony Evers says he's open to appointing Democrats and Republicans to his cabinet. The Wisconsin State Journal reports that Evers said, quote, "We have to have good, smart people. We have to have the best and the brightest." He made the comments during a visit to American Family Children's Hospital in Madison. Evers says he's looking for cabinet appointees who have expertise in their fields as he gets ready to take over as governor in a little more than a month. The governor-elect's comments come as Republicans are trying to retain Tourism Secretary Stephanie Klett. She has been in the role since 2011. Evers said Klett has, quote, "done a good job," as have other Walker appointees. He also said he's open to the possibility of appointing Republican Senator Luther Olson to replace him as state superintendent. Olson is chairman of the Senate Education Committee. Olson's office did not immediately respond to a phone call seeking comment. The United States Chemical Safety and Hazard Investigation Board has announced a public meeting in Superior next month on last April's Husky Energy refinery explosion and fire. The Duluth News Tribune reports the federal agency will host a public town hall meeting at 10 a.m. on December 12th at UW Superior's Yellow Jacket Union. You're listening to news from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from LegalZoom, committed to helping businesses with lease agreements, tax law changes, contracts reviews, and any other end-of-the-year legal hurdles. More information is available at LegalZoom.com/NPR. And from Campaign Monitor, an email marketing platform used by more than 200,000 customers worldwide, with email templates, a drag-and-drop email editor, and 24/7 customer service. More at campaignmonitor.com.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We are in the middle of open enrollment for the Affordable Care Act. It goes until December 15. People can sign up for health insurance plans under Obamacare. And holiday health insurance shoppers are finding something new this year, lower prices. Let's talk this through with Kaiser Health News correspondent Jordan Rao, who has looked at all the prices of all the plans in all the counties in the 39 states which rely on the federal government's healthcare.gov for their marketplaces, and he's here with results. Hey there.
Hey.
So what did you find?
Well, big surprise. Prices are dropping in a lot of counties, over half of the counties, and sometimes by large amounts.
We're not talking about every single plan and every single place going down, right? But what's the average thing happening?
Well, it goes from place to place. Some places like D.C. are actually going up, but a lot of places that have had very high premium hikes over the last couple of years, like in Tennessee and in Arizona, are decreasing. And we looked at a couple of different types of plans. We looked at the lowest price plan. That's a bronze plan, a high deductible plan. And then we also looked at the silver plans, which are the plans that about two-thirds of the people get.
And those are both going down by, what, a few percentage points?
It really varies from county to county. I mean, it can change a lot. But in some places, they're going down 17%, 20%.
Wow. So why would that be happening?
Well, a lot of it is that the market is correcting. The insurers went way, way high over the last couple of years because of all the political instability. You know, at the time, they were looking at the possibility that the whole thing would be repealed and replaced. And then also there have been some changes that the Republicans and President Trump have made that have destabilized the market somewhat. They've let in some plans that people can sign up that are short-term plans that don't offer all the benefits, and those the insurers feared would siphon away some of their healthier people.
Mm-hmm.
And they made some other changes as well. So the insurers just baked all that into their rates. And so for the last couple of years, people have really seen some sticker shock.
You had mentioned that prices had gone up the last couple of years because of the Republican Congress and the Trump administration. Hadn't prices actually been going up for several years, even before the Trump administration?
Right. Well, they took a big jump when these markets were created in 2014 because suddenly people could get insurance even if they had expensive conditions, and insurers had to cover all sorts of things, whereas before they could pick and choose.
Oh, when the plans got better, they also got more expensive.
That's right. You want more, you pay more. And then they continued to increase because in a lot of places, insurers decided that they didn't want to participate, that they were worried that they wouldn't make a lot of money or lose it. In some areas of the country, there would only be one insurer that was offering plans, and that insurer could set its prices wherever they want. People had no choice.
How will people feel that difference? Because a lot of these plans are subsidized anyway, right?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's two groups of people. So the people that are subsidized, and that is you get a subsidy if you're, you know, a family of four with an income under $100,000, those people may not see a big difference because they're already capped. And in some cases, one of the weird things that's happening is that because all the prices are dropping, the subsidies are dropping as well.
Hmm.
So it's possible some people may even see a small increase. But the big difference is going to be for the people that don't get a subsidy at all. And they have the potential of seeing much lower prices.
So let me ask about the prospects for the next couple of years, because you mentioned that political instability, efforts to repeal and replace Obamacare, affected the prices and helped to drive them up. Now we have a period where Democrats are about to take control of the House of Representatives. We can presume that although Republicans still have a lot of power, they're not going to repeal Obamacare now for at least the next couple of years. Does that create a stable situation where prices might come down further?
Yeah, I don't think so at all, because the fundamental underlying problems of the healthcare system are still in existence. You still have no price transparency that allows a functioning market where people can shop around. And also the ability of some providers, some hospitals, some doctors to dictate their own prices. So really, most of the fundamental elements that have led to increases for everybody are still in place.
So the good news is prices are going down. The bad news is they're still very high, and there's a big risk of further increases over time.
That's right.
Jordan, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
That's Jordan Rao of Kaiser Health News.
The Camp Fire in Northern California is now 95% contained. That is welcome news some 2 weeks after the blaze broke out and destroyed the town of Paradise. Hundreds of people are still missing, though, and the death toll continues to rise. It's now at 84. What's next for the decimated town of Paradise depends on how many of the displaced decide to go back. NPR's Bobby Allen is now going to introduce us to one couple struggling with that very decision.
The rain is falling in Paradise. The air still smells like smoke here. I'm walking through the charred rubble. All around me, there are incinerated cars. There's a stack of burnt trees over there. But there's also buildings that were untouched by the fire. And the big question now is, will residents move back to rebuild what has been lost or try to start lives away from paradise?
I've grown to love that community.
Robert Sharp is retired. A year and a half ago, he renovated a home in Paradise on top of a ridge.
My natural instinct is that I want to stay, and I suppose I'm too stubborn.
His place had an amazing view of the Mendocino Hills. All that's left of his house now is a metal roof. While he hopes to remake the property, his wife of 33 years, Amanda, is pulling the opposite way.
To run away, to find somewhere green and lush, to find a place I feel safe.
The husband and wife, originally from the UK, are conflicted like many others in the Paradise area. Return and build from the ground up, or start anew someplace else.
So many times we've left friends behind and we've moved on and created a new life for ourselves. So it's not like this is going to be an unusual challenge for us.
She's traumatized by the event. Her husband, Robert, feels attached to the close-knit community that was Paradise.
I'd begun to feel that I was in a forever community.
Many of the campfire evacuees are in Red Cross shelters, in hotel rooms, staying with family and friends, or in many shanty towns that have cropped up. Thousands are having these discussions without a home. Officials from the Federal Emergency Management Agency say 15,000 households around Paradise have registered for assistance, and FEMA has delivered more than $9 million for evacuees to stay in hotels and apartments for up to a month as they figure out what's next. Forrest Kesterson is 59, divorced, former military, and grew up in Chico. He says his next house will be far away from here.
I'm done with the whole thing.
The fire swallowed his five-bedroom home. He was just in the process of selling it.
Chico's no longer home. And I'm not going to go back to that community where it could happen again.
But for every Kesterson, there is a Russell Carroll. He's living in the same tent encampment. He's been homeless before, but he said his life was just turning around when the fire broke out.
I think we should rebuild.
Carroll says those who move back to Paradise need community support, and he wants to be a part of it. And that dwarfs any fears of another wildfire.
There could be a fire anywhere, really. I mean, I think it was just bad luck.
Butte County officials say a community will rise from the ashes, even if it's smaller than before. But it'll take time, maybe years. Bobby Allen, NPR News, Paradise, California.
This is NPR News.
This is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, and it's 8:42 right now. Ahead on the program, in the new film Green Book, a black pianist on a 1962 concert tour in the Deep South hires a tough-talking bouncer from the Bronx. Rachel Martin talks to Mahershala Ali, who plays pianist Don Shirley, in about 9 minutes here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Are you 70 and a half years old or older? Do you have a traditional IRA? Are you looking for a convenient, tax-free way to support the WPR programs you enjoy? The IRA charitable rollover is the answer. You can take your required annual distribution in the form of a gift to charity. Talk to your financial advisor or visit WPRlegacy.org for more information. Make a difference for WPR programs today. Thank you.
Support for WPR comes from many small businesses. Saturday, November 24th is Small Business Saturday, a day that encourages shopping and dining at local businesses. WPR is proud of the support we receive from small businesses.
Support for WGTD comes from the Studio of Classical Dance Arts, presenting the story of the Nutcracker December 15th and 16th at the Rita on the UW Parkside campus, featuring 69 dancers and over 150 costumes. Tickets and info at classicaldancearts.com.
You're listening to Morning Edition on WPR, and it is Friday, time for the latest WPR Politics podcast. Host John K. Wilson and WPR Capitol reporters Laurel White and Sean Johnson bring you the stories you might have missed and explore the ins and outs of Wisconsin's political scene. Go to WPR.org/politics or subscribe to the WPR Politics podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. News from NPR and WPR coming up in 15 minutes, and then classical music with Stephanie Elkins. Stay tuned.
And from Little Passports, a monthly subscription service for kids. Each package includes games, souvenirs, and activities from a new country, designed to spark curiosity and cultures around the globe. At littlepassports.com/radio. From S&P Global Market Intelligence, committed to delivering essential data and insights to business and financial professionals, S&P Global Market Intelligence, know what matters. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's 8:45 now, time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about some delicious traditional food.
Fry bread appears to have originated in the 1800s when the U.S. government forced many American Indians to move onto reservations. They were given commodities like flour, lard, and sugar to survive. Fry bread is now a staple in many Native American diets, including in Catherine Denemy's. She lives on the Bad River Reservation in northern Wisconsin, but she's originally from the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. Denemy recently showed WPR's Danielle Kading how she makes fry bread.
I'm making a dough right now. Measure out the flour, yeast, salt, sugar, and put my oil and milk in there and mix it up. When I first started, I was about 19. My mom taught me how to make it. She taught all of us how to bake. So we wouldn't starve, I guess, I don't know. And then I've had other women teach me through the years. We used to go to a lot of Powell's when I was younger. And I remember my mom being one of the main cooks for the feast. So that's all I remember is her cooking all day. So I knew, because I can do it now, she's the one that taught me. So she taught me how to make a living anyways. I seen her cook a lot of food in my life for a bunch of people, and I guess I got it in my blood. People always listen over a piece of fried bread. The young kids, they like to talk, so that's when you teach them. Keep their mouth full, and they'll listen. For me, it's a living, and it's something that Indian people eat year-round. It's not just a special. It's something we use every day. A lot of people don't make it no more by hand. And a lot of old ladies do, but not the younger ones. I don't know too many people that can make bread by hand anymore without a machine. And that's it. And then I fry it 400 degrees. And then it cooks the bread. You cook it on one side and then you flip it over and you brown it on the other side, then it's done. It's just the way we've known to make bread. We've had to make our bread over open fire. We never had ovens or anything, so usually when you make fry bread, it's a long time ago, it used to be made outside. You used to put it over a fire in a kettle, like a fry pan, and you would just put the whole thing in there. It's not something you need to make in the house or something, you know. You can make it anywhere. So that's why it was good for Indian people, because they could make their bread anywhere they were camped at for a site, you know. So it only takes about a minute or two on each side, and it's good to go.
That story was brought to us by Danielle Kading, WPR's reporter based in Superior. This story is part of a new project from Wisconsin Life called Food Traditions. It's a multimedia exploration of food, culture, and identity, and can be found at wisconsinlife.org/foodtraditions. We'll explore how panela cheese connects Jalisco, Mexico with Racine. We'll indulge in a Hmong feast in Onalaska. We'll hear family stories about rum cake in Fort Atkinson and a lutefisk dinner in a church basement. It's a discovery of food ways and traditions that celebrate cultures and communities found across Wisconsin. Those stories can be found at wisconsinlife.org/foodtraditions. And we want to hear about your own food traditions. Share them with us on Instagram. Just search for Wisconsin Life. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Support comes from Kenosha Winter Harbor Market, featuring Kenosha County-based Riverwood Produce. Best known for its springtime asparagus, Riverwood this Saturday will be offering carrots, Brussels sprouts, celery root, and other root vegetables. Winter Harbor Market is open at the Rhodey from 10 until 2.
We help you see what's going on and really understand all of it. Start your day fully awake with Morning Edition. Listen every day.
Good morning. It's 10 minutes before 9 now, and Stephanie Elkins has classical music for you starting after our newscast at the top of the hour. A concerto for four violins by Vivaldi will begin things, followed by an orchestral suite by Edward McDowell. Respighi's Ancient Airs and Dances Suite No. 1 is on the air just after 10. Stay with us. A mix of sun and clouds today, breezy, some scattered rain showers in the afternoon and evening, highs in the mid-40s.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Rachel Martin. Dawn Shirley could have been one of the most famous concert pianists in the world had it not been for the color of his skin. As a black man in 1962, Shirley was excluded from many of the great American music venues of the day. And when he decided to tour the Deep South, not only did he have to play less desirable stages and styles, he also needed a white bodyguard to get him safely from club to club. That's the story behind the new film Green Book, starring recent Oscar winner Mahershala Ali as Dawn Shirley, also known as Doc.
Yeah.
Some guy called over here, a doctor. He's looking for a driver. You interested?
I am not a medical doctor. I'm a musician. I'm about to embark on a concert tour in the Deep South. What other experience do you have?
Public relations.
That's the voice of Viggo Mortensen as Doc Shirley's driver slash bodyguard. This film is about what it was like to travel while black in the Jim Crow South. It's also about this particular relationship between Dawn Shirley and Tony Vallelonga. I talked with Mahershala Ali recently about the film, and he told me why Doc Shirley felt compelled to go south.
It would have been too easy for him to stay up north or to go to Europe and tour and travel and make money. I think he was seeking to penetrate the stereotypes, especially once you cross that Mason-Dixon line. Doc Shirley wanted to expose himself to that environment for the good of changing minds and hearts.
He knows it's going to be hard, though. He knows there's going to be trouble.
Yes.
Which is why he decides to hire a driver, not just any driver. He wants, like, a bruiser. He wants a body man. Enter Tony Vallelonga.
Yes, yes.
Known as the Lip.
Yeah.
We're made aware pretty early that Tony is a racist.
Yes, yes.
What does Dr. Shirley make of him?
Don Shirley really was intrigued by him. He thought of him more as something to observe. And you tolerate and you deal with him, but he was a bit entertained by how off-putting Tony could be at times.
Is there any part of him, though, that feels like it is just yet another indignity, that he's got to be escorted around, given this kind of white cover, in order to get into places where he's likely to experience even more indignities?
Perhaps, but I would also say that I don't think at that time, I don't know if he would have even thought he could find someone else that would be that different. If you think about a white man agreeing to work for a black man in 1962 and drive him around in the South, it would have been challenging to find someone who could check all the boxes.
Right.
And I think that he approached it, and I'm guessing a bit, but I believe he would have approached it from the standpoint of believing that he would be able to be in control of the space in the car because he is the boss.
Mm.
And he tolerates it because, you know, for him to complete this tour. He needs his presence, but Tony needs Doc as well.
It's really interesting because this is a film about friendship and about race and about class, but I thought it was also about, to some degree, masculinity and what it meant then to be a man and what it means now. And it seems, I don't know, I'd be interested in what you thought, but is it fair to say each of these men in their own way is trying to figure out that?
Yeah, that. Thank you for saying that. It's really true. It is a lot about masculinity and identity, and also giving people space to define that for themselves. You know, there's a lot of pressure on all of us culturally to, as we're born, we're constantly having this negotiation between who we feel we are or what we feel we are with what the world is saying and guiding us to be, so that we all fit nicely into, you know, our categories. It's so much more complicated than that. And I haven't seen Don Shirley's archetype before. And that was something that was really attractive to me because he was multidimensional. If you look at Nina Simone, as much as we love and appreciate Nina Simone and her contribution to music and art, Nina Simone was never the Nina Simone that she wanted to be. She wanted to be a classical pianist. Don Shirley wanted to be a classical pianist. That's the experience of the black artist in this country, constantly being pointed and steered towards what is commercially profitable or where socially you're acceptable, but not necessarily towards your talent and your freedom, and therefore eventually the fulfilling of your own potential.
What about you? You're a black artist.
Yes.
Do you feel like you are fulfilling your potential? Do you feel like you have been able to do the things you want to do?
You know what I realize, even doing this project now, looking at, you know, from my father to my grandfather, you know, grandmother, like my family, you inherit a little bit of the struggle. It means that I have to, even post-Oscar, I have to advocate for myself, you know? And I've done that. I had to advocate for my first lead opportunity. And that went extraordinarily well. But it doesn't mean that here's this trophy and then here's a leading role. It's the conditions still are what they are. But you might have to say, hey, that second lead that you've, you know, handed me this script for, that's a cool part. But I've done so much of that in my life. This leading part, I really want to play that part. That's the part I want to play. And I don't say that I'm proud and I feel fortunate to be in that place where I am in a position to speak up on certain things and perhaps change things, not only for myself, but for a whole community of people at times, you know, and any and all of us in those type of positions, when we have that kind of platform, have to be very conscious of having that responsibility and do our best to do good and be responsible with it.
The film is called Green Book. It stars Mahershala Ali as Dr. Don Shirley. Mahershala, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was written by BJ Lederman and arranged by Jim Pugh. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Melissa Ingalls, and big thanks to our producer, Hannah Haynes, who makes us sound good all week. Morning Edition is on the air every weekday from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. To follow news developments throughout the day, visit WPR.org. There you can check out statewide reports from WPR's award-winning news team. It's a minute before 9.
Support for WPR comes from Rogers Behavioral Health, providing treatment for OCD, PTSD, and eating disorders in children, teens, and adults. Programs are at locations throughout Wisconsin. RogersBH.org.
Support for WGTD comes from Piasecki Althaus, hosting Grief Share, a support group program for adults grieving the death of someone close, running every Wednesday from July 25th through October 17th from 5:30 to 7 p.m. To register, call 658-4101.
You're listening to WGTD.